on the whole, I can write a scathing review about a product. And generally speaking, the good companies will never say anything. It's the bad companies that will get upset. If I look at the companies that have been upset about reviews, they're always the companies that had questionable business practices in some way, shape, or form. Like when I created that blog, that was a Blogspot blog back in the day. When I created that, just like anyone else creating an online blog, you didn't think it was becoming anything. It was just one of those, I need a screen name, and you type in Rainmaker, and it doesn't work. And you're like, Rainmaker, that didn't work. And you just keep on working through the AOL screen names, if you will, until finally it accepts one. And it accepted DC Rainmaker, and that's what I got. I'm not used to sleeping at 8,000 feet, right? I was sleeping at 8,000 feet, you know, whatever it is, 2,000, 2,200 meters, something like that. And my body has to adapt to that. And so you see my values went from what was one day 40 down to the next day 22, which is incredibly low for me.
Great. Ray, it's a pleasure to see you. I have been following the blog for, I don't know how many years you have the blog out, but at least 10 years I have been following it myself. So I'm really excited about this. What I would want to do in this is have a brief discussion about the journey and how you started. So why don't we get started by what was your first sport?
Yes, my first, I would say like I'm a runner, well, probably I'm actually a skier, downhill skier by like early kid age, if you will. Very competitive downhill skiing. But in terms of this journey anyways, it was running. So I had been doing some running with basically various devices as my then girlfriend at the time, long time ago, had wanted to run a marathon. And this is before I became like a runner. So it was one of those like, fine, I'll go and run this marathon once. I'll check that box and never have to do this again. But I was also, at the time I worked for Microsoft and obviously you get like a bit of a tech slant to anything. So I picked up an old Polar watch, like an old Polar 625 or something like that. It was really old. It had like an external GPS pod, like the size of a like a Twinkie that you put somewhere. Like it was just not great. But that whole thing then kind of, from there, I tried, I didn't like the, wasn't a great experience. So I went off and bought then the Garmin Forerunner 305, which is sort of this infamous watch or famous watch. That's a red, orangey red color, big blocky thing. And most people would say it was like the starting point of the GPS watch generation. And lots of people back in that, you know, 2008, 2009 era had these. And you find them at marathons everywhere. So I was using this for a few months. And at the time, again, working for Microsoft, there was an internal distribution group for triathletes. I started getting to dabbling into triathlon a little bit. And on that DL I had sent out was effectively like a product review about this watch, which was only like six paragraphs long, right? Without pictures or anything like that. It was not very long. But I ended up just taking that and one day copying and pasting it into a blog post. And I started my blog the same day I signed up for Ironman Canada back in 2007. So it was one of those I signed up for. That was back in the days when you had to go to the races in person and sign up. You couldn't like just do it online. So you had to go a year before the race, the previous year's race, sign up in person. And that was like my first post. And then a few months later, I decided just to copy and paste that email that was my product review into a blog post. And that became my first product review for what was then the first, you know, Garmin watch I tried. And for that era, like back 2007, 2008 timeframe, product reviews were mostly done by magazines, right? They were mostly done by magazines that were advertorial in nature, right? So it was, you know, one hand washing the other sort of thing. And usually pretty useless. And so for me, coming from a tech slant, I took that, I had pictures in it, lots of details. And at that time, that was like insanely detailed. If you look back at that same post now, you're like, that looks pretty short compared to your user reviews. But that was sort of the journey. And then from there, every new stupid sports gadget that I bought, I ended up just typing something up and posting it online.
You mentioned Microsoft. What were you doing there?
I was a data center engineer. Originally based in Washington, D.C., and then I moved to Europe. And basically, I flew to a different country every single week to work with customers in the data center space, designing really large host data centers, like 10,000 servers plus sort of thing.
Mm. And but how did the idea of the first review came about? Was it just, I'm just going to do one review, or was it that you really thought about it?
No, totally did not at all think about it. This was purely just a copy and paste of the internal email that I made. from an internal Microsoft email that I just made a bunch of, you know, friends on this triathlon group, to what became just my first post, like a first post in that review sense. And it was one of those like, oh, I use this, I copy, I'll paste it over here, we'll call it done. That's a new post for the day, right? And this is back in the days when my blog would have had like 50 visitors a day, right? And we're talking very small numbers. And so I didn't really think about it much. And I certainly didn't think about this becoming a big thing. I definitely probably would have named it something other than DC Rainmaker, which has no meaningful, like useful anything for people trying to figure out what it's about. But again, you like when I created that blog, that was a Blogspot blog back in the day. When I created that, just like anyone else creating an online blog, you didn't think it was becoming anything. It was just one of those, I need a screen name, and you type in Rainmaker and it doesn't work. And you're like, Rainmaker, that didn't work. And you just keep on working through the AOL screen names, if you will, until finally it accepts one. And it accepted DC Rainmaker, and that's what I got.
I think everyone went through in these days of the domains, searching for the right domain. It was so difficult. What was the first, you mentioned that you tried to send it to friends in WhatsApp and so on. What was the reception? What made you think that I should do a second one and a third one?
I think it was, I mean, after posting it online, there was just, you know, in a very small community of people that read my post, everyone was kind of like, wow, this is really detailed, way more detailed than we usually get for a product of any sort from anyone for review. And so my next one, I added more detail. And, you know, for my day job was basically designing data centers and then documenting the crap out of it, right? So I would have, you know, these 100 to 150 page long documents on how just the server portion would work. And my job would be to write about all these pieces and put screenshots in there and diagrams, stuff like that. So that was sort of the same like general thing that I used on my reviews. I'm going to explain how this all works. So it is obviously part review, and I'm going to tell you what parts are good and what parts are bad. But my real ultimate goal was to tell you how it actually works, right? So take all the marketing junk aside and tell you, this is how these features actually work. And these features are great because of that. And these features are bad because of that. And then when a feature is bad, to explain why it's bad and get that company, ideally that company's viewpoint on why it's bad. Meaning that, you know, as you know, most engineers don't start off to design a feature and go, how can we make this feature suck? Right? Like that's not how it works. You get boxed into design constraints. And my goal was to help people understand those design constraints. They may not agree with the end result, but I found that most people, when they understand why things were the way they were, they have a much greater appreciation for the product or for technology as a whole. And that was sort of my goal.
And then how many blogs in did you realize that this could become a business?
I don't know the quantity, but I would say like 4 to 5 years in. I think the first couple years was just me mostly posting about like my training and racing, right? Like a personal blog, you know, very casual Blogspot style. And then over time, I began to post more and more tech stuff into the blend, right? Where it was, you know, for the first few years, if you had a week where I had, say, 5 or 6 blog posts, pretty good chance that 5 or 6 out of those 6 blog posts were just about random training stuff, life and whatever else. Over time, it became like 1 a week that was tech things, and then 2 or 3, and then so on, where, you know, eventually I think now, for the most part, it's pretty rare that I post non-tech stuff to the blog. It tends to be tech focused. And, you know, part of that's just over time, your priorities shift and that's the focus that people want to see and so on. But yeah, I'd say it was a few years once I started making that transition. And then I think once it got to the point where it was like, oh, this is taking up a lot of time, then that was maybe I should start figuring out how to monetize this and make it into something.
Mm. The first distributions you used was where?
The first distribution, like a platform or?
No, in terms of how did you try to find the first, you mentioned WhatsApp at the beginning, but then how was it word of mouth that people were sharing between them or?
Yeah, more or less. You know, back in the like the blogging days, I mean, it's certainly blogging is very popular today as well, right? And we all like think it's just podcasts and Twitter and whatever else, but people certainly, you know, write blogs all the time. And I think one of the things that you learn very early on when you're writing a blog is you have to do what my wife kind of referred to as being like an Easter bunny or a bunny rabbit, with other blogs. So you have to go to all of the people that you read their blogs and basically write a comment. And a comment, you know, is generally a well-meaning, useful comment about the content of that post. And then that person then eventually writes a comment back on your post, and someone else sees the comment and it's linked to your post. That's just this like circular comment thing. And, you know, I think there's obviously a very fine line there sometimes between commenting for support of someone else's post and what is effectively spam, right? So that's the same, like, how do you find that? And I think, at least I hope I was pretty good in that. I cared about the people that I was writing comments on. But over time, that grew into more people looking at my posts. And then, you know, I'd have like a little signature line in a forum. So if I was really active in forums, then, you know, like in triathlon forums or cycling or whatever the case was, people would see my little signature line. I just have my blog there. And that was sort of like the entry point. And eventually Google takes over on some of that stuff. But back in the early days of that, there wasn't, you know, search wasn't a major driver at that point.
Hmm. So you used the comments to comment to other blogs, and then more people saw it from that. That brought more viewers to your blog. That's very interesting. And that, would you say that was the main driver for the first 4 years until it became something that would be sustainable, or did you do something else too?
No, I'd say like at least the first 2 years, that was probably the main driver of, you know, just community driven organic traffic, if you will. But yeah, over time, I think as you put more and more posts out there, and Google does the Google thing of indexing stuff, it starts to pull in, and you get more, like, I did a post on how to use CO2, right? Like nothing for CO2 cartridges for cycling. Nothing very fancy, but that became a popular post because I wrote it in a way that was different than things were written at the time. That was very like, you know, something written by a bike shop in one or two paragraphs, and that's it, right? So mine was much more detailed on how to actually do this and so on. So that kind of stuff that eventually pulled in people via search, and it slowly grew from there. And I began to kind of post more and more interesting tech stories, which again, Google would index. And so over time, you get people that came in from just general search for something else and became hooked on the site and subscribed to it and so on.
I was always noticing what you said earlier about being very transparent about what's good and what's bad. In the early days, did companies come to you saying, you know what, you wrote a bad review about this and this? Was there any issues with the companies themselves?
Very rarely. You know, it's really fascinating. I find that on the whole, I can write a scathing review about a product, and generally speaking, the good companies will never say anything. It's the bad companies that will get upset without fail. Meaning that if I look at the companies that have been upset about reviews, they're always the companies that had questionable business practices in some way, shape, or form. Versus I find that if I write a scathing review about a product at, you know, Garmin or GoPro or fill in the blank, DJI, et cetera, they generally know when they've got a crap product. It's pretty interesting. Like I think most companies that have good engineers and so on know when they're putting something out that isn't done yet. And they know when that they're putting out something that they probably shouldn't. And I was talking to someone from the industry last week, and they said, you know, we've learned to appreciate that when you write a review, there's sort of two parts of it. There's the factual part and there's the opinion part. And that you're very good at ensuring that here's the facts of the product and here's how it works and what exactly it does and does not do. And that is correct. And then the opinion part, that, you know, I may value one portion of a product higher than another portion, right? And I may say this portion here is great because of XYZ, but in the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter, or vice versa, right? And that's actually one of the core reasons why years ago I got rid of ratings on the site. So when I first started, I don't know, a long time ago, I used to put ratings on things. I used to give them a score of, I think it was 1 out of 5 or 1 out of 10. And eventually I pulled that away because it was incredibly difficult to find any objective criteria for how to give a rating on a product that has so many features, because one person would value one feature incredibly highly. Another person didn't care a single bit about that feature. And so eventually I just pulled those away. And I got to a point where I'm confident that if people care enough about the product, care enough about the review, they're going to read the portions they need to read and figure out whether the product makes sense. And I think most people, giving, I think, enough credit, you know, can read at least the summary section and get the gist of it. Like my summary sections on reviews are pretty templatized at this point. Like the first paragraph is a summary of the entire review. The second paragraph is the things that I liked a lot. Third paragraph is the things that I think suck. The fourth paragraph is, you know, where I think they can go from here. The fifth paragraph just tidies it all up, right? It's like it's a very clear-cut process that I think, if nothing else, people can read that last review, last section. But as far as the companies, yeah, I've had two companies, I think, in total, both kind of Kickstarter-y sort of things that got very upset. One kind of threatened to sue me. Both went out of business, and both have effectively ended up scamming their customers in the process. So it's kind of seems to hold true.
And then at the beginning, again, were you buying the products yourself, or did the company send them to you?
Yeah, buy them all myself. Eventually, I don't know, like 2011, 2012, some of the time frame, companies are sending products. And, you know, my thing is that I want to send back the products when I'm done. So I don't want to keep anything. No money changes hands. There's none of that. And so my goal is to get every product that's sent to me back to that company. Sometimes companies go out of business in that process, or they're sitting here piled up because they haven't, you know, figured out how to get it back into their country, whatever the case is. But like, I go out and rebuy the vast majority of my products. And the ones that I don't buy are because I don't have any use to buy them again. Like they're not great. Or if they're multiple iterations of the same thing, like I don't rebuy every single color size variant of the Phoenix. But I do buy the core sizes. So I will rebuy a Phoenix 7S and a Phoenix 7 and a Phoenix 7X, the three core sizes, so that I have that for future comparisons. Like just an hour ago, I published a product video and post about firmware updates, right? And that was on...
I was reading it because I'm wearing an Epix.
Yeah, exactly. So the Epix was in there too. And those are all units I've gone out and repurchased, right? So we're talking 4 units worth, right? So what, $3,000 roughly worth of watches, just so I can write these type of posts, that exact type of post of here's a firmware update that went out. And yeah, it's definitely expensive. There's no kidding around that. I like having that. I don't have to be beholden to anyone. Like I don't want the products. Like if the thing I hate most, my day-to-day job here is dealing with shipping and receiving, going back. It's like the bane of my existence, right? Especially because I've now got to ship outbound from here to umpteen different countries. If it was in my like ideal world, there would be some magic little like laundry hole, like the, you know, houses where you just drop the device in, it just disappears to somewhere when I'm done with it. That would be amazing. But no, I just like the separation that no one's going to be saying, oh, you did that, you took that, you did that review well, or the review was good because the company gave you a product, or because the company paid for ads, or whatever the case is. That's not my thing.
So you do that from an ethical perspective, so nobody comes and says that they're paying me to do that.
Yep, exactly. And also because I'm not beholden to any company, right? Like, you know, if a company is giving me a product like permanently, a lot of times with companies have all these weird strings attached, right? They need to review the review first. They need to, I'm like, no, you don't, nobody gets to review my reviews before they get published. None of that happens. You're not paying me for this. There's no guarantee a review even happens. I mean, there's literally an entire table of things over here that I hope to get to at some point, right? Like some of them are sitting there for months and I'll try to get to them. But there's definitely no guarantee that a review is going to happen. And there's certainly no guarantee it's going to be good. I'm just going to call it like it is. The one thing I will generally guarantee, though, is that if I'm having problems with the product, I'm going to ask you about those problems. I'm going to like say, hey, I'm having this problem. Is this just Ray being dumb? Or is this a legit problem? Is there a fix for this? If the fix is not here today, is it coming? I want to give a company their opportunity to say their piece. I think that's totally fine. And they may say their piece and I may come back and be like, here's what the company said, here's why that's garbage. But I'm going to give them their opportunity to do that. And I think companies respect that when they know that. And, you know, generally speaking, the more, you know, useful in providing information a company is, the better I can explain the situation, right? Or if a company is very combative and is like, nope, this is all we're going to do, we're all we're saying, it's like, well, I can't help you then, right? So.
How would you say that the blog evolved? Like, if we don't go into YouTube or anything like this, but how did it evolve from the early days to today?
I think things have gotten deeper in depth in the topics. I think I've focused more on the things I know that I'm really good at and focus less on the things that I'm not so good at. So like...
Such as what?
I would say like 10 or 15 years ago, I would have written topics a little bit on nutrition things that were interesting to me at the time that I thought I knew well at the time that were more casual posts, just stuff like, oh, here's how this worked out for me. I've written stuff on that sort of realm of like things that, you know, were interesting to me personally, but I was not an expert on. And, you know, now I'm generally not writing stuff unless can say I'm an expert on that, right? So I'll talk in depth about something, but I don't generally go too far outside my swim lane. And that I have plenty of things I could write about on a day-to-day basis that I don't need to go off in left or right field just for the sake of it, right? So I can really dive into the stuff that I know well and give people a perspective that hopefully that they can't get anywhere else.
And then would you say that today most of the traffic comes to you from Google, or did this evolve as well?
It's all over the place. A fair chunk obviously comes from Google, but a lot of people have just RSS feed type stuff. So they've got, you know, social media piping it in. A lot of it comes from forums and other locations and Reddit, et cetera, linked across the internet. I mean, the inbound, you know, number of links to the site orders in the millions. So it's just, there's my goal. I know people a lot of times say like, you want to make content that people want to share, right? And so my goal in a lot of posts is to be able to make posts that someone's like, holy crap, that was a super cool post for any number of reasons, super great review or super detailed insight into something else. Let me post it somewhere else. Let me go and post it to this, you know, bike club or to Reddit or to whatever the case is, and to do that. And certainly I also have posts that are more informational, right? Like even the firmware update post today, that's an informational post, but that's a prime example of a post that would get posted to Reddit. Someone's going to post that and be like, here, I'm posting it to the Garmin Fenix, you know, subreddit or something like that, or a Facebook group dedicated to Garmin Fenix users. And I'm trying to give more information than you would normally get by itself.
And how do you actually see that? Like, I noticed that you, for example, for the Epix one and the Fenix that you posted today, you see those very early and you write articles very early. How do you keep track of it?
I'm just trying to mentally. So like for certain things, I'm getting notifications ahead of time. I'm seeing updates, even just on my watch, that lets me know that it's out there. Some things I've got early access in beta, either, you know, pre-announcement of a product or pre-announcement of a new beta version, et cetera. It just depends. And I'm just mentally trying to hit whatever dates they are. So in this case, this update actually came out, I think, 2 days ago. I had almost this entire thing already done a week ago. In anticipation, I kind of knew it was probably going to happen because they dropped the 400 955 and they dropped the Instinct 2 and they had said these updates were coming. So I had pre-written almost this entire post last Friday and had everything ready to go. I even shot the entire video last Friday knowing the features that were coming because Garmin already had said the features that were coming. And those are the same features that were on the Epix and Fenix Pro series. So I had plenty of experience with all those things. The only thing I didn't really have was the final B-roll showing the firmware update and all that kind of stuff on the older units, if that makes sense. So that's where I had prepped it all. It was ready to go. I think they dropped the firmware update Wednesday night, or Tuesday night. I was at the Tour de France that night, completely slammed. And then Wednesday, I was slammed in the Alps riding all day long. And then Thursday, I was slammed traveling, trying to get back to the Alps. So it was one of those like, I had it all ready, but I've only got so many hours in the day, right? It's just me. So I can only do so much and eventually just gotta sleep.
Mm. And in terms of YouTube, what was the first video and what was your idea about launching through YouTube at the very beginning?
So at the very beginning, YouTube for me was just a dumping ground for showing little snippets of how something worked. So I use YouTube back, I don't know, 11, 12 years ago now, something like that. And it was literally just a place for me in my reviews. You could host on YouTube at the time. Like you could have a blog spot because it was all owned by Google. And you would say, oh, do you want to use YouTube as your video upload platform. So I would put like little 45 to 60 second hands-on clips with no audio whatsoever. They were just like me thumbing through the menus on something, or that was it. And sometimes there would be me talking, you know, in the background, but this was one continuous clip. There was no editing whatsoever. And I uploaded this way for probably 5 to 6 years. And YouTube was just literally a dumping ground for, you know, one-shot clips. So when I finally started to actually care about YouTube, it was funny because I had amassed this huge subscriber base of people that had effectively low expectations because I was just uploading, you know, like 1 to 3 minute clips of nothing. And so I actually started to, you know, like edit a video or at least pretend to edit a video. And it was like, oh, wow, that one did really well. And I think it was probably 4 or 5 years ago, something like that, where I really started to actually focus on YouTube as a platform in terms of spending time and editing a video. But even today, it still complements the site. I think, you know, overall, my breakdown between the site and YouTube, they've kind of found their own like landing spots, if you will. And, you know, I'll meet people all the time and they'll say, oh, I love your channel. And they know nothing about the site, or vice versa. They know everything about the site, know nothing about YouTube. And so it's, you know, I cover the same general topics, but the depth that I cover them depends a little bit on whether it's YouTube or on the site.
And then do you, when you're doing a review, would you do the video together with the review, the written one, or do you split these?
Totally. Yeah. So there, if I'm going to do a YouTube video on something, or vice versa, my goal is to drop them the exact same second. Cause then I got a boost, right? Where people on a site might click on the YouTube video and click play. And so that to me is my goal. There are times though, when I just simply don't have the time to do both. And then I decide which one it is. So for example, if it's on something about, Apple Watch power meter support earlier in the week, my goal was to do both, have a video and a post, but I just didn't have the hours left in the day with other things I had to do this week. So I had the post done and I did not do a video for that, because I know that power meter support on an Apple Watch is a relatively niche thing at this point in time, that resonates well on a site, but probably won't resonate as well on YouTube. So if I have to balance my time, where's my greater ROI? And so I didn't do one there. And then inversely, on some drone stuff or some action camera stuff that does exceptionally well on YouTube, does not do as well on the site. You know, people generally speaking aren't looking for really long form action camera or drone reviews in written form or written world anymore. They want it on YouTube. And that makes sense because you're looking at video quality and things like that. So my priority there is first the YouTube video. And then if I have time, I will try to get the post at the same time. And that's, you know, I'm constantly talking to companies when they're asking, how early do you want a product? And you know, it's a balance. Generally speaking, I actually don't want a product like 8 months early or anything like that before it's announced. I want it, generally speaking, like 3 to 8 weeks is sort of the sweet spot. Like it's usually pretty stable. I'm not going to run into too many issues. The UI is locked down. I don't generally want things where the UI is constantly changing, because then I shoot a bunch of stuff and have to reshoot it at the very last second. And I don't want to be running into bugs constantly. Not that I have no problem like dealing with bugs in beta and getting the feedback back to companies, but there's also just a reality of how much time I have to spend, you know, doing someone else's QA.
Mm. And when it comes to YouTube again, would you say that the main driver of the people looking at the videos were coming from the blog, or did the YouTube algorithm work in a different way?
In the beginning, I think it was definitely the blog, because that was the only place that did it. But these days, it's totally the YouTube algorithm doing its thing, right? It's just over time, I'm sure that shifted because, you know, people watch these random 1 to 3 minute clips and YouTube algorithm says, hey, if someone likes this content, they're probably gonna like this content, and did its thing. But yeah, it's funny to look back on, you know, the bar for YouTube success has dramatically increased in the last 3 to 5 years. And I could never start what I did then now on YouTube and think it's going to succeed, right? The quality bar in certain segments anyways is so much higher than it used to be. And I think it's even true today. Like even today, I think it'd be difficult with my current quality level to start with zero subscribers, right? And build out. I think that's really, really tough. My goal is to produce a quality video, but not an exceptionally cinematic video, right? Like I am a cinema geek through and through, but I'm constrained by time, right? I have to decide, will I spend 3 hours on a 3-second intro, right? Which I will absolutely do. That is a blast. But then the business part of my brain goes, no, I could spend that 3 hours on another video. I could spend that 3 hours creating a second or third post. I can spend that 3 hours any number of times. That is that 3-second intro that is amazeballs. Is that going to meaningfully change the trajectory of this video? And unfortunately, most cases, the answer is no, it's not, right? It's not going to change the trajectory of my video because of the audience I've already built up. Versus for someone else, it might, right? There's a sports tech reviewer, Matt LeGrand, who does amazing cinematic intros. And he's relatively new in the YouTube scene, only in the last couple of years. And amazing cinematography throughout his videos, really, really cool stuff. And I would guess a large portion of his success is due to that, you know, how much time he's spending on the video side of it. And it's super cool. I'm really jealous of what he has in there. And he's also lucky that he doesn't have to also write an entire post on the site, right? So it's one of those, I'm trying to accomplish both as opposed to choosing just one.
Yeah. Now, when it comes to other social media, like Twitter, for example, and then probably Threads that started here, I don't know what's your impression there, but how are you using those? Are you using them as distribution towards customers, or are you having a different approach in each platform?
Yeah, I would say, so I'm on Instagram, Threads, Twitter, and Facebook is a business, if that will make sense. So Facebook for me, from a business standpoint, is purely just, I'm posting posts there. And, you know, so people can know that my content's been published somewhere else or published around the site or on YouTube, et cetera. And then I'm engaging in various technical Facebook pages as me. So like a Zwift page or a Garmin users page, that kind of stuff, right? Where I'm there answering questions and stuff like that. In Twitter, for me, it's answering questions across from all sorts of people and having conversations with people and retweeting interesting things in the sports tech space, as well as broadcasting what's my own content. Threads, I just try to make Threads work. I was trying this afternoon and I couldn't post anything all afternoon long. I'm not sure why. I've been like updated the app and I'm excited to see where Threads is going. Might have launched a little bit early, but you know, I think I'll probably use Threads in a very similar manner to Twitter. And at the end of the day, for Instagram, for me, that is probably like my little secret geeky outlet of sorts that I just get to play on. And so if someone goes to my Instagram profile, they'll probably see a photo post from a year ago. That's the last time I probably posted a photo to it. But I post stories virtually all day long. Today, I haven't posted anything, kind of quiet all day long, but I post a lot of Instagram stories and it's sort of the behind the scenes of what I'm doing as best as I can. A lot of things I can't show, of course, because they're under embargo, et cetera. But I'm constantly posting tech stuff and travel. And I was, you know, the tour on Tuesday. Yeah. And it was just a constant stream of both a blend of like interesting tech tidbits behind the tour, but also like hilarity things behind the tour, things that you would never see as a normal person because you can't get into those zones and things like that, in the technical zones and all those areas. You know, like I posted about the team Trek is a cycling team, and they have this fruit stand because their main sponsor is a grocery store. And at this new fruit stand, they've just added to the front of their team bus. So you've imagined a team bus that's super serious, has all their bikes out front, all the riders, and they've made this small little fruit stand, like not much bigger than me, right? And it's every day, it's someone's job to bring fresh fruit to this fruit stand basket and have it there. And there's all these fruits there that you can come and take, you know, pears and apples and all that kind of stuff. But there's a pineapple. And there's a pineapple there every day. And I'm like, who takes the pineapple? Because, you know, you're just walking around the team bus area in this whole technical zone. I mean, you can't just like bite into a pineapple, right? So you, yeah. I mean, like whoever takes this? So it's been this like sort of inside joke now for a few weeks as I've been stopping in out of the tour, where every day I'd be like, take a new picture of the bus. And I'd be like, yep, pineapple's still there, still in the fruit basket. Nobody took it. So, you know, I was there this past week at the time trial stage. I finally went up and I asked like the lady that was behind it. I'm like, what is the deal with the pineapple? Tell me, like, does anyone ever take it? We had a whole chat and discussion about it. And so it's those sort of entertaining tidbits that, you know, I think people enjoy on the Instagram side.
I'm wondering why is Twitter not good for that? Do you think that it would work there too? Or?
I think it would. I think in fairness, it actually, that's how it started. Like, so if I went back 7 years ago, 5 to 7 years ago on my Tour de France, adventures, I did the exact same thing on Twitter. I literally posted the exact same pictures and video on Twitter. And they showed up there. And arguably it's better because that stuff lives forever, right? It's more obvious. It's more there. I don't know why. I think Instagram just sort of worked out. I would agree that I think, you know, Twitter is probably an equally good place for it to post those insights and has broader shareability, I would say, than Instagram does for stories anyways. I don't know why I shifted. I guess for me over time, Twitter became a bit more formal for me, if you will, like a little more, not curated, but versus Instagram stories just became very, very casual, right? It's just, which I guess the point, right? You think about Instagram stories, it disappears after 24 hours, you post, you don't really care so much about it. Certainly, though, there are lots of people that post constantly to Twitter in the same way as Instagram stories, and that's cool too.
I also noticed that you always answer comments, be it on the website, on the blog, be it on Reddit, be it in Twitter, like everywhere. Like, first of all, how much time do you spend? Second thing, like, why do you go so extensive?
Yeah, I spend way too much time. I'm sure if this was a business run by someone other than me, my boss would be like, you need to spend less time answering comments. But I think it's important. I think it's one of those things that, you know, it's people understand that I'm going to make an attempt. I do try to find a balance, like for things that people can easily look up the answer to, like how do I turn off my watch? Like you can figure this out yourself sort of thing, right? Someone else can figure that out. But I think especially for answers where I might be the only person that knows that answer, I try to help out. So, you know, obviously people always ask me like opinion on one watch versus another, and I can give my opinion on that. But there are many cases where they're asking, what is so-and-so company going to do about this update or about this or that? And I may be one of the only people out there that can actually get that answer. And that can, you know, if someone's asking like some questions today on the post or whatever, when will this come to X watch, or will this feature come to Y watch? You know, I can easily shoot an email to Garmin or to Suunto or Polar or even Apple and ask those questions and get answers back usually within a couple hours, versus very few people have that opportunity. So I try to use those opportunities to get those answers back for people. And I think that's, people find that valuable and hopefully find a reason to keep coming back to the site.
I'm just I'm writing questions down as long as we go, no, because I have so many to ask you. But one of the things I wanted to ask is, which wearables went out of business that you really liked? And
that's a tough one. There were lots of wearables that had good concepts, but challenging executions, right? So I would say like there was a watch, I don't know, 8-10 years ago called Leiker, L-E-I-K-R or something like that. That was like this small square display watch. It sat at an angle on your wrist. Super interesting looking design. And for the time, it was crazy. It had mapping. It was like almost like a Kindle style display out. And really cool. And I think they made it barely into shipping before they went out of business. And that was one that I would say one of the first companies to really run headfirst into the realities of making a multi-sport watch is really, really hard. You know, back 10 years ago, companies like TomTom and Adidas, I mean, Adidas made a really cool watch at the time. Adidas, if you're European, made a very, very cool watch at the time, like way ahead of its time. It had, you know, music connectivity. It had an LCD AMOLED display.
I remember it, yeah.
Yeah, it was insane. Nothing like it. But one of the challenges that when you make these watches that are so advanced, or theoretically advanced anyways, is that you're judged against what was mostly the time the Garmin bar. In other words, does it have X feature or Y feature? And people, you know, get really entrenched in the features that they have, and they won't switch watches without that feature. And and Garmin at that point had figured out how to make a watch. They knew how to make a watch, so they got over that initial bump. And thus, every year, they just simply added more and more features and theoretically increased quality, versus a new watch company has to first get over the hump of making a watch, right? Something that's waterproof and usable and all that kind of stuff, and all the software to go with it, and the updates and the apps. And that's a huge bar to get to just a basic running watch, let alone to get to a multi-sport watch, or to get to a hiking watch, or a mapping watch, or music, like all those things. And so Leica, and to a large extent, Adidas as well, you know, learned, unfortunately, that it is very, very hard to compete with Garmin. And also with Garmin's complete vertical integration, right? They have their own factories, their own manufacturing facilities. Like, they own those facilities in Taiwan. And they can easily go from, you know, a production line of one watch to the next watch overnight if they want to, right? They can ramp up here and ramp down there and so on. It's a huge chunk of their success. The same goes for, they reuse watch models, right? So you look at a Garmin Forerunner watch gets reused as a golfing watch and a marine watch and so on, right? All the different areas that, like, as a fitness person, you'd be like, I don't care about, you know, a dog tracking watch, but Garmin does. And they reuse that exact same watch with some new firmware on it, and now it's a dog tracking watch. So the cost structures are different. And all these things make it, I would argue, virtually impossible now to enter the market with a watch, with a, you know, smartwatch in 2023. Between them and Apple, and to a lesser extent, I think you can kind of do it on with Wear OS. I think you can pull it off if you've got a really, really good team that can, you know, use that base very, very well, and then jumpstart it with some exceptional sports features. But even then, it's exceptionally difficult. And it's too bad. I mean, we went from an era 10 years ago where you had TomTom and Timex and Adidas and Leica and Mio and Polar and Suunto and all these other companies. And yes, Polar and Suunto are here today, but they have nowhere near the you know, power they did 10 years ago. I mean, that was, it was Polar, Suunto, Garmin 10 years ago. And now it's, you know, Garmin, Apple, Samsung. And it's too bad, because I think we'll lose competition over time because of that.
Mm. I wanted to also ask you about, if we take the case of each company, if you were the chief product officer or CMO, if you'd like, what would you do? Would you be up for that?
I would never want to be a watchmaker companies, anything. I would say, generally speaking, I would look to leverage data insights more in watches, right? So, you know, Garmin, generally speaking, is very, very good at hardware. Most people would say Garmin is exceptionally good at building hardware, the quality levels, all that kind of stuff. And people would say historically Garmin has struggled a bit with software. I think they've really churned that course in the last 2 to 3 years, especially with their beta programs and things like that. They found a better thing. It's not perfect by any means, but they definitely shifted course. But if we look at Garmin, if we look at Suunto, look at Polar, look at Chorus, look at all these companies, virtually none of them, including Apple, are really using the power of the data they have. So, you know, Garmin gets millions and millions of activities a day uploaded, and isn't really using that in any forward-looking way that we can see as consumers. And some may argue that's great for privacy, and I think there's some truth to that. But at the same time, you know, I saw an example that I've been talking about a lot for a long time is Shane Miller, GP Lama, who writes or does cycling YouTube videos, kind of posted a Twitter thread on the other day, and I've been talking about it for a while, is that, you know, these companies have so much data on the cycling routes we ride, and the speeds we go in the radar, now that we have bike radars that can detect vehicles and overtaking speeds, and, you know, many, many cyclists now ride with bike radars that detect all this, yet no one's using data for routing purposes, meaning that these companies have collected data to know that, hey, on this stretch of road, cars are overtaking on average with an overtake speed of 40 miles an hour, meaning 40 miles an hour faster than your current speed. That's probably more dangerous than this road over here has an overtake speed on average of 10 miles an hour over the cyclist. Why are these companies looking at these data sets and going, how do we route you as a cyclist on the safer route, right? And that's something that doesn't happen today. And those are just one example of many areas where the data just isn't really being leveraged in any obvious way.
Why do you think it's a case though? Because I think like when Apple came into this game, that they're really good at software, they're going to push it. And I, personally, I agree with you so much. I'm always using Garmin devices, but the software is not good.
I think, you know, it's just a bit of like a hiring thing. I think Garmin, you know, has really, and again, they're getting better and better. We see that with what they're doing, but you know, they're in Kansas, right? So there is years ago, there was the time when Garmin's basically, they bought a company, Motion Based, which was a precursor to Garmin Connect. So back 13, 14 years ago, there was, you know, Strava just starting out, and there was something called Motion Based, which was kind of like Map My Run at the time. And Motion Based got really, really popular. And Garmin decided to buy Motion Based, the company. And it was roughly 25 or 30 employees from the Bay Area. And Garmin said, okay, now you need to move to Kansas. And all these employees from the Bay Area said, nah, we're not moving to Kansas. And Garmin took that platform and that team, you can actually like read my old post about it. The team literally put themselves up for sale. So they sold off the platform to Garmin. Garmin had now rebranded as Garmin Connect, but it was still Motion-based. Like you could find like little things here and there that, you know, reference Motion-based. But the team sold itself off to the highest bidder, which ended up being basically Magellan, more or less. They're like GPS competitor for the you know, personnel value of that. Garmin then had a period of a couple of years where they only had literally two people on staff to deal with Garmin Connect issues, right? And they would admit now, they have admitted anyways in the last, you know, 5-6 years ago, that was arguably one of their biggest mistakes, was letting that, and because in doing so, they really let Strava eat a lot of what could have been a Garmin's lunch, right? And now we see Strava is the neutral territory, right? The Swiss of devices where everything fits into that. And that was certainly the case way back then, but Garmin could have really expanded Garmin Connect 10 years ago and just made it so much bigger that it might have deterred people from other platforms, and they didn't. And I don't know, you know, people obviously moved to Kansas, right? But there's still a reality that Garmin tends to want a lot of people locally there, that I think that might be hindering some of that.
Hmm. And then which of the software companies are you excited about? You mentioned Strava, Swift maybe. Which ones do you really like?
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see innovation from lots of companies, both startups and, you know, bigger ones. Zwift has been fascinating to watch that journey over the last few years as it's gone to this kind of unicorn status, and also to see the challenges they face as well, right? As they grow, and then the pandemic just exploded their business in a good way. But now it's also like many businesses that, you know, exploded due to COVID. There's that implosion sort of happening of people leaving the platform because they don't want to be stuck inside anymore. But I think Zwift is also finding their footing again after that. That mostly happened probably a year and a half ago in terms of that leveling out. And now they're starting to find their place again. I'm keen to see where companies like Wahoo Fitness go over the next year or two, now that they bought themselves back from private equity back a couple months ago. You know, will they get their mojo back? Wahoo Fitness used to be, you know, when they first really started getting in the game, I mean, 10 years ago, they put out of business the CompuTrainer, which at the time was like the most highly vaulted brand of indoor trainers. Be like putting out the equivalent of Kodak and putting them out of business, right? It's just unfathomable to think about. But they did that. And even, you know, CompuTrainer's founders would admit it was Wahoo that put them out of business. And so from there, they went into making bike computers, and they started a revolution for a few years of Garmin and Wahoo going back and forth on feature updates and new devices. And it was one of the best times ever for consumers in the bike computer industry, because these two companies were competing head to head, very much like the old, you know, Internet Explorer and, you know, kind of like Netscape days back in the day, right? Like way back, this head to head, like amazing stuff. But then over time, Garmin grew bigger and Wahoo, I'd say, probably got a bit distracted with other projects and expanding into more areas and more devices and more things and got away from their core focus. And now I don't see Wahoo's bike computers as competitive anymore to Garmin, certainly not, or even Hammerhead, Karoo, which is from SRAM, or some of the other options out there. These companies have come in and kind of eat their lunch. So it'll be interesting to see, though, now that Wahoo is saying they're refocusing a bit, whether or not that changes things, whether they get their mojo back.
When it comes to data points, heart rate variability, heart rate, glucose, which ones are you really using?
So, you know, I think HRV is interesting, but you need to kind of trust but verify, right? One of the things is HRV, I've talked about this a little bit, is it was originally designed to determine which people were going to survive in the emergency room. Not designed, but that's originally, its original use case was they would, when they're triaging a bunch of people in an overcrowded hospital ER, they would look at HRV as a way to figure out which person had the least likely chance of dying. And over the last 4 to 5 years, sports tech companies have tried to twist this into being something that's going to predict, you know, sports performance and all sorts of things, right? And I think we've, about 2 years ago, we got to kind of peak craziness in that, where it's like, we're just going to take an HRV value and call it good. But HRV values are impacted by so many factors. And not all of them mean you're going to die, and not all of them mean that you shouldn't go out and train. I mean, there is, you know, if you look at HRV, so heart rate variability is basically measuring kind of the time in between beats, if you will, and how much it varies. So, you know, in general, a lower HRV value of, say, 20 or 30 means something is probably not great in your body. And in general, a higher HRV value, like 70 or 80, means things are probably good. In general, I float around the 50 to 60 times, you know, HRV values most of the time. But it changes person to person. And there are factors as to why one person could be flipped on that, or why one person could be skewed much higher, where their high or normal is 100 and their low is 50. So it's very personal, which makes it kind of difficult to explain. It's also very slow moving. So a couple years ago, like when Whoop, even to this day to some degree, when Whoop gives a HRV value, they simply give an HRV value of that night and call it good. But if the points that they used during that time are, you know, weird, or they didn't capture the data correctly, then you can get really low HRV values or really high HRV values. And the example I give that often happens to me is I'll do transatlantic flights quite a bit. And I may only sleep like an hour on that flight, right? And if for whatever reason during that hour, because your HRV values throughout the night vary. So it could, you know, start off at 40 or 50 and it's just constantly moving throughout the night. It could dip down to 20 for a little while and up to 100 for a while, and then whatever the case is. But if for that 1 hour I'm awake, according to Whoop, and I was had a really high HRV value, then it, or 1 hour of sleep, sorry, then it it would say, yep, you are fully good, ready to recover. Well, we all know if I slept for an hour on a, you know, transatlantic flight, I'm probably feeling like crap. The right answer there is not to go and to do a hard workout that day. In that case, it's probably to get to recover, an easy day, et cetera. So we saw Fitbit and then Garmin introduce more variables into this, where they would say, okay, let's look at sleep. Let's look at sleep for tonight compared to the last 3 days, compared to the last 7 days, last time period. Let's look at stress, let's look at recovery. And I think what Fitbit and Garmin have done have really kind of been the best of those worlds of looking at all these factors and realizing that HRV is best viewed over longer periods of time. So in the case of Garmin, for example, you have to establish a 19-day baseline. And that extends out to a 90-day period. And that makes it easier to see what how things are trending. Because like, again, back to factors, HRV can easily be influenced by alcohol, drugs, sleep, jet lag, you know, drugs, both good and bad, right? Just taking something for a cold, or taking marijuana, whatever the case is, or, you know, consuming marijuana in some capacity. Those are all things that can impact it, both good and bad. And that may or not impact your ability to train, which is sort of the core point of why companies are using HRV, is to tell you whether or not you're ready to train the next day. Altitude, like when I was in the Alps last few days, my HRV values plummeted because I'm not used to sleeping at 8,000 feet, right? I was sleeping at 8,000 feet, you know, and whatever it is, 2,000, 2,200 meters, something like that. And my body has to adapt to that. And so you see my values went from what was one day 40 down to the next day 22, which is incredibly low for me. And it would recover, you know, over time if I stayed there longer. I saw the same thing a month and a half ago when I was in Colorado and in the mountains there. But those are all factors that people have to understand. And that's why I don't see HRV as the like end all answer to everything. I think it's valuable. You should look at it. You should understand it. Another great example is three nights ago, whatever it was, on my Garmin watch, I woke up in the middle of the night because there was a crazy thunderstorm out. And for whatever reason, the watch then split my night of sleep. And usually it's really good about this, but it wasn't this time. And it said my sleep started at 4:45 in the morning and ended at 8 in the morning, right? So now it has a really skewed version of reality versus a reality I fell asleep at 1 a.m. or so. So it's losing half of my sleep. In that case, that plummeted my training readiness scores, it plummeted my sleep scores, it plummeted my HRV scores, like all those things are impacted. So that's where you really need to look at that data and go, okay, here's what the watch is saying. Do I agree with what the watch is saying in terms of feel? And 9 out of 10 times, I find, at least in the case of Garmin and Fitbit, that yeah, it's matching what I'm feeling. If I feel like crap and the watch says I, you know, look like crap, then they're probably right. I probably should consider that and consider what like what a coach would say to me if I was training as to whether or not to go out and do that hard workout.
Would you expect the companies like Garmin to follow what pricing strategy Aura has and Whoop with the subscriptions?
I don't think so. I thought they might for a while, but Garmin has really come out. I mean, for a company that is incredibly conservative from a financial and risk standpoint, not like talking political conservative, but like just a very financially and risk adverse company, and they will be the first to admit that. They started about a year or two ago, really started to push back on the whole you don't have to pay for your data thing. And at the time, they were attacking effectively, indirectly, both Fitbit and Whoop. And they've really doubled down on that. And the first time they tested the messaging was in an interview with, I think, The Verge, with one of their venue product managers. And it was a quote in there, and it was like, that's interesting. Because they, you know, it was a big enough quote that they said, we will never charge you for access to your own data, right? And you're like, that's a pretty big quote to say. And then they tested that quote again in a press release about 2 months later for one of the venue things as well. And now they've since done entire, you know, Twitter campaigns around it, right? The whole idea of we are not going to charge you for your data is yours. Now, that doesn't mean Garmin's not going to do subscription services. They just won't do it for your data, right? So, for example, Garmin has long had, I mean, we're talking like 10, 15 years, had subscription services for fancy maps, like high-end bird's eye imagery type maps. So, you know, satellite imagery maps that you can buy above and beyond products. They just have rolled that out in the last year to their wearables where you can now pay, I think it's like 40 or 50 bucks a year to download satellite imagery maps to your watch. You still have your normal maps that are totally free on there, but if you want to get all sorts of fancy other maps, you can do that for a subscription fee. And they have inReach devices with a subscription fee for, you know, satellite SOS type stuff. So it'll be interesting to see. I don't think that we're going to see them do subscription revenue, but I also think that maybe why we haven't seen them introduce a Whoop type competitor, because for them, you know, if they were to make a device like the Whoop that just, you know, man here, right, that's going to cost them, I would guess, price-wise, they would price at it $200-$300, give or take, without a subscription revenue. That would eat into their Phoenix and whatever else sales. Because I kind of understand that as to why they might not be doing that.
Yeah. Last question I wanted to ask you, two kind of questions. The first one is, what do you think is going to happen in the wearable space within the next 5 years? And then what should we expect from the blog and from Decision Maker in general within the next 5 years?
I think wearables, unfortunately, will become effectively a three companies race. I think it'll become the race of Garmin, Samsung, and Google. If Google manages to stay with it, right? Like, that's the challenge. Anytime Google gets into something, you don't know when they get bored of something and decide to go somewhere else. So I think we'll have the answer to that this fall. Meaning, will we see a Google Pixel 2 this fall? In my mind, if we do not see a Google Pixel 2 this fall, that sets some serious doubts on Google's desire to stick with it. And I'd hope they do that. But we've also seen relatively few software updates for the Pixel over the last year. Yes, they've updated it every 3 or 4 months, but they haven't been like blockbuster updates. Like, we look at what Garmin dropped today for the, you know, the Phoenix and Epix and so on. You're talking 50 new features, like substantial new features for just this quarterly update, right? I mean, the last quarterly update for the Pixel Watch was 3-4 new features. And that was, you know, for the entire 3 to 5 month period. So that said, I could also see how Google might be holding things back. And they might be saying, you know what, we're going to do a giant drop of new stuff in the fall and be our, you know, kabam moment. So I'm really interested to see what that looks like. You know, likewise, Apple seems like they've got they're playing the long game here. Obviously, you know, Apple is selling the most watches out there. For anyone, that's no surprise. But the real question is, can they really meaningfully eat into Garmin's lunch? And, you know, to date, the Apple Watch has come out and Garmin has continued to sell more and more and more and more watches every single year, right? Everyone predicted Garmin would die, and Garmin's never had better years financially from the watch side or from an entire business standpoint. So it'll be interesting to see. Apple has, you know, very clearly churned their ship towards Garmin as of June of 2022 with all these, you know, very advanced fitness focused features. It did it again last month with cycling power and stuff like that. And will, you know, how long will it take Apple to get to the next piece, which is around the mapping and the routing and those areas. And those are, you know, areas that really target Garmin directly. But I think for the next 3 to 5 years, you're going to look at this effectively three horse race with other smaller companies like Koro, Suunto, and Polar kind of circling on the outside edge in the endurance space anyways.
And then for decision maker?
For me, I am horrible with like long-term planning. I deal with like one thing at a time. I plan out till next week. That's about it. You know, I don't know. I think there is a reality to, I have built out two basically big businesses, right? One being the site and one being YouTube. And I try on a day-to-day basis to seesaw balance those together with just me being just me, basically, right? Me creating the content and all these things. I don't know if that's sustainable. I don't know. That is not sustainable forever to do that and to work, you know, 80 hours a week sort of thing every week for year in, year out. So I think there may be an opportunity down the road to find people to help on the periphery of some things. So, you know, I look at entities like MKBHD on YouTube, you know, very popular there, as sort of examples of how to grow your business without losing you as the focus of the business. Like, I fully understand that people come to my site or come to YouTube to understand what I have to say about it, or what at least someone very, very knowledgeable has to say about it. So I don't think I ever want to get away from that. But there are things that I don't really enjoy doing or don't have the time to enjoy doing. So like, I like editing videos, but I have literally a backlog of videos stretching back a year now of things that need to be finished editing. I shoot so many videos. I shot a video just yesterday in the Alps that I frankly have no idea when I'm going to edit or how I'm going to have the time to edit that. But I know I could easily hand off that footage to someone else and be like, make something cool out of this, right? I have tons of cool things in there. You can do that. And then I can do the final passes and so on. So I think there's that stuff that I would like to explore a bit more just to find, so that I can focus on the things that I really enjoy doing, which is like poking apart things and figuring out how they work and then shooting the video on it, but then ultimately letting someone else edit the majority of that down to something that's concise.
Excellent. Ray, thank you so much.
Yeah, no, thank you for chatting. It's been fun.